Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference, one word at a time. Now here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
And welcome, everyone. Welcome. Today's show is all about decisions and the choices we make, and sometimes to our own detriment, the choices we fail to make. My first guest today is leading expert Dr. Walter Afield, and he'll share why some emotional incidents can push certain people over the edge, leading to decisions that often end in tragedy. Later, if you have problems making decisions, my second guest today teaches people how to create options when they see no solutions. And better yet, Roger Dawson shares how to avoid issues that keep you awake at night in the first place. And we'll end today's show with Barbara and Shannon Kelly, mother and daughter feminists and authors who say that today's women have too many choices. Many are stuck in the analysis paralysis, grass is greener syndrome, and longing for the road not traveled. Their philosophy? Well, they say get over it. Ditch the endless quest for perfect and find a life that's right for you. And we'll find out more about that later. But first, I'm very pleased to welcome Dr. Afield. He's a leading authority on medical and mental health topics with 50 years experience in the medical field. He's the president and CEO of Neuropsychiatric Institute and is on the staff of Tampa General Hospital and St. Joseph's Hospital in Tampa, Florida. Dr. Afield has testified in criminal court concerning the mental health of hundreds of criminals, including high-profile cases such as Seattle's Ted Bundy. And he's testified before the U.S. Congress in the Congressional Record on the U.S. study of mental health care abuses. He's taught at Johns Hopkins, Harvard, and the University of South Florida Medical Schools. And you've probably seen him many times on CNN, ABC, NBC, etc. He's very much in demand. So I want to welcome Dr. Walter Afield to the show today. Dr. Afield, welcome.
Glad to be with you. I'm glad to be with you.
I can't hear Dr. Afield, Eric.
I'm here.
Oh, okay. We can. I'm sorry. You know what? I should say, just in case we have any glitches today, we have a brand new studio here. This is our first time in it, and I'm sitting here and I can't hear a thing. Now I can hear you. All right.
Okay.
So welcome to the show, Dr. Afield. Pleased to have you here.
Glad to be with you.
I want to talk a little bit, first of all, about why you do this kind of work. I mean, you teach, you work with patients, you've testified in court hearings, you've testified before Congress. What is it that drives you to do this work in the psychiatric and medical field?
Oh, goodness, I've been wanting to be a doctor since I was four. My parents said, be a doctor, and that's what I did. But, I've been at the top institutions, and I've worked for a long time. I feel like I've been at it a long, long time, although it seems like just yesterday. I'm just interested in people, what makes them tick, and I continue to work full time, 60, 70 hours a week. My philosophy is work till you drop, but I like seeing people. I've fallen into the issue of criminals. The first time I saw one was the Boston Strangler in 1964 when I was a young resident at Harvard, and I've been seeing murderers, serial killers, all kinds of things. Eileen Wuornos is the last one I saw, our female serial killer, before she was executed. So I've been interested in that. I've also dealt with chronic pain issues, head injuries, all kinds of mental illness. And I'm very outspoken in a variety of areas.
Yeah. I think for me, the fascination comes in what you said earlier, in what makes people tick, what makes people do certain things, what makes me tick, what makes the world tick around.
Well, I think Winston Churchill said it best, that most of the things done in the world are done, 95% are done by people who are not mentally well. And I think he's quite correct. We all have hang-ups. We all have problems with our kids, with our families, with our mothers, with our fathers. Everybody has a skeleton in their closet or a bunch of them. And there's nothing wrong with that. When you have the problems under control, you go on with life. You need a monkey on your back to make you succeed. And that really, there are various things that do that. There's nothing wrong with having the problems. When the problems have you, then you wind up seeing people like me.
Okay.
But by and large, you want to You want to try avoid seeing people like me and keep your problems under control and move on with life.
Well,
that's kind of what makes them tick.
Exactly. And it's good there are people like you in the world to to help us out. But I you know, I know a lot of people have stopped watching the news. That when I'm out and about, people say, oh, I don't watch the news anymore. It's just full of horrifying stories. And we certainly do hear our share of that. But today I want to focus on, we're going to have to probably look at one of those horrifying stories, but to figure out what makes people tick. You know, when we do hear about, you know, mothers killing their children, or, you know, husband, wife, suicide, murder, or a gun shooting, you know, in a mall or something. I want to look at some of those common things that maybe we can, I don't know if we can foresee them, but are there commonalities? And so let's start with, what are the primary triggers for somebody who is under pressure when they go off the deep end like that?
Everybody has a turning point. Everybody has a pressure point where they can't go beyond. But, a lot of it depends on your childhood, the breaks you got, how well you coped. Did you have somebody supporting you emotionally? Were there somebody there, even if they were a little crazy or even if they were alcoholics? I guess Bill Clinton is one of the better examples. I mean, he had to stand up to his alcoholic father who's breaking the door down to attack his mother. He turns that into becoming president of the United States. And there's the other person who will turn it into becoming a serial killer or a murderer. We can't foresee these coming, and there's really a very difficult way to predict who's going to make it and who isn't. I used to predict all the time about teenagers, this one's going to make it, this one isn't. And I'd be constantly confounded. The ones who I thought were going to make it didn't. Mm-hmm. The ones who I didn't think made it on top because somebody pushed, there was somebody there to care, and they had enough proper brains or something to move ahead. You don't need to be a genius to do that. You just need to be able to pull yourself together, focus, and be able to make some relationships. But we all are a little screwed up. Again, that's okay because, you know, that's how society works. It's when you kill yourself or when you kill your kids or something like that, one begins to think we're seeing more of it. At first, I didn't think we were, but I thought it was just a very high incidence of reporting. It's on the Internet instantly. Charlie Sheen's on the Internet. For the major stories, woman driving her, killing her kids, or this and that. It happens all the time. It's been going around since biblical times. If you read the Old Testament, it's shocking how one tribe was killing another tribe and back and forth and back and forth. A lot is culture. A lot is community you're in. In a civilized country like ours, we're not supposed to have that, but we have a fair amount of violence going on all the time. We don't have a full answer for it. It's basically parents aren't doing their jobs. There's been a breakup in family structure. You have the loss in authority with the churches. You've got a loss in authority with the universities. There are a few hero figures to look up to, except a bunch of, you know, kind of creepy rock and roll people who are sort of, you know, kind of airheads, as far as I can see. Now, these are our heroes today.
My producer's raising his eyebrows at that because he's a rock and roll.
I think you know what I mean. We've got a bunch of airheads who just have nothing behind them, and those are our heroes. Where are the Mother Teresa's? Where are the generals? You got General Petraeus. Well, that's nice, but all the authority figures in the political world these days, people don't pay any attention to them.
Well, I think it's true that
any political thing. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I think it's true that this has gone on throughout history, but reporting is so instantaneous now, and unfortunately, the media just jumps on the story and just won't let it go. And of course, I have to, you know, the one that pops into my mind is the mother who drove into a river, I think it was last month, with her three children. One of her children managed to escape. How does that boy who managed to escape, his mother purposefully drove them into the river, he's with his three siblings, they all drowned, but how does that boy even begin to recover? He was just 10 years old.
It depends on who he's got as a family. I mean, his mother was 25, so, you know, she had him when she was very young.
Mm.
Depends who he's got as family, who loves him, and who cares about him. A lot of things can turn around. Sure, you're going to be scared. I've seen people who've had their mother killed their father and then killed themselves in front of them, and yet they do very well and become fairly successful in business or in social work. Yet they have some problems in their marriage and they have some scars from it, but some function very well. It's keeping the problems under control. Others totally fall apart. Mm-hmm. Basically, I only know what's in the media in that situation, but it sounds like a very deprived family. And, you know, that kid has many things going against him. He may not make it. So much depends on, you know, who steps in right now.
So if we're... If we all have mental challenges, most of us have mental challenges, as you said, and if there's no real predictor about, you know, who's going to go off the deep end, are there maybe certain behavior patterns that change before an incident like this? Is it usually one incident that does trigger it? You talked about turning points.
It's usually one incident that triggers a violent kind of episode, but it's somebody who's got long-standing kinds of problems with it. Problems with abuse as a kid, problems with incest, problems with, they're torturing animals when they're teenagers. As they get older, they start getting in trouble with the law. They're starting abusing drugs. These are the kinds of things. And most people deny it or sweep it under the rug. They don't want to look at it in their kids. And these kids, all of a sudden, they don't emerge killers at 25. It's been a long-standing development of a distorted kind of view of growing up. As a human being, there are some people who are killers who are just professional hitmen, and they look at it as, and they're very scary. I mean, they just look at it as a piece of meat that they're going to butcher. The others, the serial killers, are very charming, very nice, but and you really can't predict it. You try to talk in retrospect. Well, they had this with their mother and this with their father, etc. Well, they don't fit into a clear profile.
Hmm.
And there are always the people who go out and shoot people in fits of anger, and frequently they're very normal like you and me. They get into violence.
How much do you think our economic times play into it, if at all?
Well, at first I didn't think it played much of a time, but what I see in practice now, people are scared to death, and they have been for the past couple of years, but it's really gotten very much out of control, and I think... people can't get employment. They think the country's falling apart. The news media, because it's so efficient today, something happens in Afghanistan or something happens in Africa or something happens in New York, it's in your room, wherever you live. So there's that enormous fear factor, and you get these constant negative kinds of things. That's what makes news. People get depressed, and people are very concerned, and people see their jobs and their futures, what's going to happen. You are seeing more problems. I think people are reeling under it. We're fortunate in this country that we still have the greatest lifestyle in the world, but even here, it's scaring everybody half to death. You go over to Africa, Afghanistan, people are in the Sudan or all this kind, they're just living hand to mouth. So it doesn't quite as affect them as much. I remember years ago, there was an Indian person on the faculty with me, John Hopkins. Father had been in Gandhi's cabinet, and he said, well, you know, these people, he was a doctor, he said, these people, I grew up in India, I take care of these people, but they're supposed to die because that's what's expected. And people don't worry about mental illness in India. If they've got a roof over their head and a meal, then they're successful. That's kind of a shocking thing. This was back in the 60s. Well, mm-hmm. As you see it more and more now, I mean, those are basics that people have to live with.
Right. When we hear stories of parents hurting their children, many cases killing them, it seems like the ultimate betrayal, especially I think maybe more so even with mothers because they actually give birth to that child. Are mothers more prone to do something like that than fathers? And if so, why?
We don't know. There's been some recent information coming out saying, well, yes, mothers have negative feelings about their children. Well, so do fathers have negative feelings about their children. Beasts will kill their young. We're supposed to be a lot more sophisticated, but they've been talking about it since Greek times and the Greek plays and so forth. Mothers and fathers do kill their kids. Again, it depends on the times, the society, the religious background, what's going on. In Roman times, there was no Christianity. There were no Judaism that they understood, and it was basically a survival kind of mode, and they thought nothing of killing each other or killing brothers, sisters, etc. People do get angry, and when children are born, there is a wonderful, powerful feeling of love and affection, but there also is this negative part mm-hmm. that creeps in. Nobody likes to admit to it, but it's there, and If it gets accentuated and pushed, you get a woman who goes into a bad depression after birth, or a husband who will go into it. Sometimes they'll act out and kill their kids, or they'll be drunk, or they do this and that.
Well, we're almost at the end of our segment, Dr. Afield, and I want to ask you before we go, if somebody feels they're in trouble or, you know, it has a loved one they feel is in trouble, how do they go about getting the right kind of help before they tip over the edge?
Well, I think you ought to call your local medical society and find a good psychiatrist or a good psychologist. The difficulty is don't let the doctors throw pills at you, which they want to do these days, and not talk about symptoms. You want someone who can talk, you can talk to, well-credentialed, but are you comfortable with them? Does it feel right? You can tell on a goose pimple test right away. If all they want to do is give you a pill or this or that, change to somebody else. But seek some help. There's nothing wrong with seeking help, and that's an age-old way of doing it.
Right.
Unfortunately, it doesn't come in the churches. It used to, but it doesn't. So you really sort of have to find some decent mental health people, but there are some quacks in it, too.
Right. And we have to remember, too, that, you know, the pill pushers, if somebody's pushing pills, some of those pills do exacerbate those mental conditions, don't they?
Quite a bit. Quite a bit. Doing this a long time. And pills do not solve the problem, contrary to what the TV and the drug companies tell you. And the doctors are all pushing them today. It's a mistake.
Well, I thank you so much for being with us today, Dr. Afield. Website where people can find out more about you, I have neuropsychiatric.net, correct?
That's correct. That's
okay. Right. Thank you so much for being with us, Dr. Afield.
Good luck. I'm sorry there are no answers.
Well, forewarned is forearmed. That's the way I look at it. And my guest today, Dr. Walter Afield. He's quite the expert on these kind of situations. You can find out more about him at neuropsychiatric.net. And when we come back, we'll be joined by Roger Dawson. Please do stay with us. We'll be right back. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair.
Parkinson's disease affects as many as 1 million people in the United States. At the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, it's our mission to beat this disease. To learn about the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, or if you want to help support our work, visit our website, pdf.org, or call us at 800-457-6676. In the Northwest, contact the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation at nwpf.
Next week on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair, Seattle filmmaker, director, and producer John Jacobson discusses insights into living a creative life and what it means to pursue your passion. Later in the show, Vicki will talk with New York Times bestselling author Douglas Preston for his views on discipline and spontaneity. Tune in Monday at noon Pacific for Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Follow Vicki on Twitter at Vicki St. Clair.
Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Listen to podcasts of past shows at conversationslive.net.
Bringing you fresh perspectives every day. Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
And welcome back, everyone. Well, if you have problems making decisions, and I know I did this weekend... then you'll want to stay tuned because Roger Dawson is the former president of one of California's largest real estate companies. Since 1982, he's been a full-time professional speaker and was inducted into the Speaker Hall of Fame in 1991, along with such greats as Ronald Reagan and Norman Vincent Peale, Zig Ziglar. He's also the renowned author of 16 books, including Secrets of Power Negotiating, Confident Decision Making, and Secrets of Power Persuasion. Roger Dawson's latest book is called The Secrets of Power Problem Solving, and it provides proven techniques and surefire strategies for solving everything the world throws at you. Roger Dawson, welcome.
Oh, great to be with you, Vicki. Everybody seems to be wallowing in problems these days, but the difficulty is they're focused on the problem and worrying about the problem when they should be worrying about the process of solving the problem.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right on that. Sometimes that problem just is there and we can't get around it. So why don't we start taking a look at how we get around that? Well, first of all, tell us about your book. It's called The Secrets of Power Problem Solving. You say it solves everything the world throws at you. Everything?
That may be a little bit of hyperbole. But problems range all the way from I have so many solutions, I don't know which one to pick, all the way down to I don't see any way out of this mess at all. And there's processes for each of those. For example, a situation where you have so many choices you don't know what to do is when you're in an airport bookstore and you want to buy a book to read on the flight on the way home in case you can't sleep. And the more you look at all these titles, the more confused you get. What you should be doing is using the process of requirements. What do you want out of that book? And you might come to the conclusion you want one of three things, or all three things. You want to buy a paperback, not a hardcover. You want it to be an author that you've read before. And you don't want it to be anything too heavy for a late-night flight. So those are your three criteria. And you start looking at the books, and the first book that meets all three of those criteria is the one you pick. You don't fret about all the rest of it. Just use your criteria that you want and solve it. At the other end of the scale, you've got problems where there just is no solution to choose from. And that's when we teach creative thinking. We teach 10 creative thinking steps to come up with choices, to come up with more than one solution so that you're making a better choice.
Mm. I know my guests are coming on after you say that today we have too many choices. Do you think that's true? They say we get too many choices and it can cause us overwhelm. And I just read the very same thing in Tim Ferriss's book, The 4-Hour Workweek. What's your take on the amount of choices we have?
Well, we're certainly overwhelmed by information. I think so many of these things we worry about because we see it on cable news. 50 years ago, we would not have been worrying about these things. It would not have involved us. So we tend to get overwhelmed with these problems. But I have to say that the more choices you have to your more solutions you have to the problem you're faced with, the better your choice is going to make. Now, take Arnold Schwarzenegger for a while.
Must we?
I'm sure he's racking his brains trying to come up with just one solution that could possibly work on a good day.
Oh, my God. That was not a good decision for him, I don't think.
And you can also have situations where you've got to make a decision quickly. So one of your first thoughts is, do I need to make a decision right now, or would I be okay waiting? Now, take the famous case of Sully Sullenberg, the U.S. Air pilot flying from Newark to, North Carolina somewhere,
mm-hmm,
I think.
Mm-hmm.
And he flies into a flock of Canadian geese, and both engines go down, which is a rare event. That'll happen once every 25 years or so. And he's got to make a decision quickly. I mean, within 60 seconds, he's got to decide, do I go back to Newark? Do I try and land in Peterborough in New Jersey? Or what else have I got available to me? And the solution he came up with was, I'm going to put the plane down in the river. Now, the thing about having decided that is then you can focus totally on making that one solution work.
Yeah.
Having made the choice, you don't sit there saying, I'm not sure about going into the river. It's awfully cold in January. Maybe I ought to think about going back to Newark again. No. You make a decision, and you're confident enough in your decision-making ability that you've used the right process, come to the right conclusion, and then you solely work on making that solution work.
Yeah, and boy, did he make that work. I read an interview with him where he said that every day of his life had prepared him for that particular event.
It was an amazing coincidence. When I first read about that, I couldn't believe this. This man had flown F-14s in Vietnam. He'd flown for United Airlines in that type of plane for 29 years. He actually had started a company. He was a consultant for pilots, teaching them how to deal with trouble situations like that. He was the one person that needed to be in that captain's chair when that happened. It was an amazing thing.
Yeah. You say in the book, treat every problem as a golden opportunity. Well, if this problem is something you really don't want to deal with, you obviously have to deal with it. Otherwise, it's not going to go away. How do you focus around that?
sometimes, Vicky, you don't need to deal with. And a lot of people rush in and start solving the problem when maybe they're better off not doing anything for a while. And this is particularly true where you have a case of a problem where it's a do we or don't we problem. Do we buy this new office building or don't we? Do we buy this other company or don't we? Do we go skiing this weekend or don't we? When you have a do we or don't we decision, you should always be thinking first, what happens if we do nothing? If I don't buy the building now, will I still be able to buy it a month from now, or is this a one-time opportunity? And the classic example of this was the Branch Davidian Group down in Waco, Texas.
Mm-hmm.
Janet Reno, the attorney general, had a decision. They circled this place for about 45 days at this point. Should we invade or should we not invade? What she should have been thinking was, what happens if we don't? Now, she tried to make the case that children were being molested inside there, but she knew perfectly well that was not true. The FBI had sent milk cartons in with microphones in them. They knew exactly what was going on. Nobody was being harmed inside that compound. It had turned into a political situation. They should have just thrown a fence around it and waited it out. By the time they got to the following year to the FBI and the Freeman situation in Montana, these were a group of people who felt they were exempt from having to pay taxes, they had learned the lesson. They simply posted FBI agents on all the access roads. It took them 9 months before they surrendered. But eventually everybody surrendered. They went off to jail and nobody got hurt.
Mm.
So if we have a do we or don't we decision, the first shot should be, what happens if I don't?
Yes, and you know what? That's proving very helpful to me to focus on something that I'm trying to figure out. What happens if I don't? I think that's...
Yeah, this guy's asking you to marry him, and your first thought should be, what happens if I'm not ready to make a decision yet?
No. all right, so you also talk about making your intuition work for you. How do we make our intuition work for us?
Yeah, unfortunately, we've kind of moved away from intuition with the amount of information that's available to us these days through the internet, and you can have a mainframe computer that can do a decision-making tree and calculate thousands and thousands of decisions. What's the point in this old-fashioned intuition of just sitting there and turning off your left brain, your logical thinking brain, and let your creative brain work on it? Well, the truth of the matter is, while our brains are incredible things, there's some things our brains are not very good at. And the machines can't solve the problem. We need to put that intuition to work. Some people are remarkably good at it, but typically when you look at it, it wasn't because they were skilled. They had the process down of overloading yourself with information on the topic until the solution occurred to you.
Okay. You mentioned earlier, you talk about 10 ways to create others to create options when you see no solutions. I wonder if we could look at maybe what you rate as the top three solutions or top three options to create options.
Well, I think the first one is to visualize the opposite of the situation. Take the traffic problems that we have in Los Angeles now. It's ridiculous. It's taking an hour and 15 minutes each way for people to get to work these days.
Mm.
And the assumption is that everybody wants to drive their car to their work to be the closest they possibly can. If you assume that the opposite is true, people don't want to get into their cars to go to work at all of a sudden your mind opens up to all these different solutions, like carpooling. The company sends out a van and picks up these people. That's a better solution for the people than it is to get into their car and pay $4.20 a gallon for gas. The other one that I like very much is visualizing yourself finding the perfect answer. Just to sit down quietly and say, okay, this is the perfect solution. If this happened, I'd be in a hog heaven. It wouldn't get any better than this. And having created that in your mind, figure out, back out through that and decide, how did I get to that situation where the perfect solution occurred to me?
Yeah, I think that's very powerful, too.
I think everybody should have standards that they live their life by. Companies should have a clear mission statement. This is the business we're in. And that way they don't get sidetracked on all different things. I consulted with a company whose mission was, we're going to have the largest chain of auto repair stores where people can either bring the car in to be repaired or buy the parts from us and do it themselves. That was the mission statement. Very good one, very clear, very easy to understand. But they got into trouble when they got an opportunity to buy some Chinese mini bikes. And some buyer said, we can make a fortune selling Chinese mission bikes. But it's not part of our mission statement. Never mind, we're going to make a lot of money doing it. An absolute disaster. Mm-hmm. Just a disaster. They had different parts of these mini bikes spread all over the country. They couldn't put them together. They should have gone to their mission statement and said, this is the way we're going with this company. Now, there's nothing wrong with you changing the mission statement. You can say, oh, I want to do this, plus I want to sell Chinese minibikes, but don't digress from your path. And the same thing applies to your personal standards. When you're driving a car, the light turns yellow. Do you have a standard that says, I stop for yellow lights or I gun for yellow lights? If you know what you're going to do, you don't get into all that stressful decision-making at the last minute. If someone's waiting to pull out of a parking lot in front of me, do I wait them in front of me or don't I? Have a standard. This is the way I run my life. I always wait them in or I never wait them in. And then you don't get all fretted out with all these minor decisions you have to make.
I like that idea a lot. And I'm glad that you mentioned mission statements because I have a mission statement, which I think I've been ignoring a little lately. but I know from past experience that having that mission statement during times of when you have to make a very difficult decision, especially a decision that could be life-altering, it can really help focus you on making that decision.
Yes. Like, never go to bed with a man who's got more problems than you do.
That's a good one. I want to talk about avoiding problems in the first place. Now, you said earlier we don't have to necessarily address all problems as they come in. Sometimes they'll take care of themselves. But how do we avoid them in the first place?
Well, you know, I found an interesting thing about that, Vicky. And people who've read my books will email me or call me in my office. And sometimes I'm away on a speaking tour and I can't get back to them for 3 or 4 days. Over half of those problems are solved by the time I get to these people 3 days later. They panicked when they first heard about the problem, and then when they did nothing about it, 3 days later the problem had solved itself. So I'm in big favor of just waiting and let the old world take a couple of whirls, as Frank Sinatra sang in September song, and just see what happens.
I'm going to ask Eric what he said. You said before the show started, my producer said, I think sometimes procrastination is underrated, right?
That's exactly what I said, yeah.
So you just echo that. You know, sometimes we do tend to jump in too quickly, and if we just leave the situation alone, it will resolve itself.
Very often it does.
Yeah. So we're almost at the end of our segment, Roger, and I want to let our listeners know about your website because you've got some great articles up there on negotiation for anybody who has to go into negotiations. You've also got some video clips, which I thought were really interesting. So tell us a little bit about, give us your website, first of all. It's rogerdawson.com, I believe, right?
Yes, that's right. And as you said, there's all kinds of help there that you don't have to necessarily spend any money, although that would be nice.
Thank
you. This is a business, not a religion we're running here.
Yeah, and the book is called, you've still got your British sense of humor, see? And your latest book is called Secrets of Power Problem Solving. What would you like our listeners to take away with them today, Roger, about the secrets of power problem solving?
To anybody who's sitting there fretting about a problem, there is a solution. We all tend to think, nobody's ever faced this problem. I've got a mentally ill child. I'm panicking. I don't know what to do. The truth of the matter is there are thousands of people out there who face the same problem. Get yourself in contact with these people. Learn what they have already learned.
Great. I appreciate you being with us today. And your website, again, is rogerdawson.com. Thank you, Roger, for being with us.
Thank you, Vicky. Great to be with you.
And please do stay with us when we come back. We'll be joined by Barbara Kelly, and her new book is called Undecided. Please stay with us. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair.
Looking for unconditional love, an exercise buddy, or a great listener? Pause has the dog or cat of your dreams, just waiting to meet you. We've made thousands of perfect matches since 1967 because everyone needs a warm, safe place to call home. Find out more today at pause.org or call 425-787-2500.
Hi, I'm Andrea Kay, America's leading career expert. I know it's going to be a great conversation when Vicki St. Clair asked me to offer my career advice on her show. Vicki asks thoughtful questions, she's thorough, she works hard to bring you great guests who walk their talk with information and solutions that can lift your career and better your life so that you'll live well, live strong. My advice? Tune into our conversations and all the interviews on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair for thought-provoking insight and tips on the things that really matter in your life. And visit AndreaKay.com, that's Andrea, K-A-Y.com, for information about my books and loads of free practical advice and inspiration for your career.
Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Follow me on Twitter at Vicki St. Clair.
Listen live at 1150kknw.com. Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
And welcome back, everyone. Well, we're talking about decision-making loosely today. And my next guest has written with her daughter a book called Undecided, How to Ditch the Endless Quest for the Perfect and Find the Career and Life That's Right for You. Barbara Kelly and Shannon Kelly wrote this together. And Barbara Kelly is with me today. So let me read you a little bit about Barbara. She teaches journalism and directs the journalism emphasis at Santa Clara University. She's a freelance journalist and has written for daily newspapers as well as a variety of national magazines, including the LA Times, Utney Reader, Parenting Magazine, Red Book, and many others. And Barbara Kelly, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Vicki. I'm happy to be here.
And I just want to give Shannon a little mention here. I know she's unavailable today. We're expecting her to be with us, but she's a columnist at the Santa Barbara Independent. She's also a freelance writer. So you guys decided, you got together. Tell us how this book came about.
Interesting story. As you mentioned, I teach at Santa Clara, and I stay in very close touch with a lot of my former students. And about around spring of 2008, I went through a stretch where I was getting email after email from all these accomplished women who were out in the world and miserable. They had what looked like good jobs. They had a great education. They were living in very cool places, but yet they felt something is just not right. And a lot of it stemmed from the sense of dissatisfaction or second-guessing themselves. Have they made the right choices? Maybe all the promises were not what they cracked up to be. So, long story short, I did a short op-ed for the Christian Science Monitor on this whole issue of choice overload and how it affects women, and it was picked up by the alumni magazine at my university, and the feedback was pretty phenomenal. Everybody said, yeah, you know, I recognize that. That's me. That's my daughter. I felt that way myself for years. And flash forward a few months to a family vacation at a small beach town outside of San Francisco, and my daughter Shannon and I went on this long, grueling hike one day. I mean, it was, you know, 7 miles of up and down a mountain. Mm-hmm. And at the end, we stopped at a local pub and had an ice-cold beer because it was a hot day and started talking about the issues in the book. And Shannon said, Mom, it's just not enough to document that this is happening. We have to investigate it. Let's really look into it. Let's find out what's going on, what causes it, how to alleviate it, and let's do it together. And of course, she had me at together, and so we started brainstorming that night, and the result was the book.
And here's what I find interesting, Barbara. You say that it's not a changed world, and yet we've seen all these recent firsts for women. You know, we had the first female vice president running with a Republican campaign. We're earning more college degrees. We make up the majority of the American workforce. We had the first female presidential candidate, the first female Speaker of the House. And yet you say it's really not a changed world for women.
Well, I mean, it is in terms of the opportunity. You know, just about a generation ago, women would come out of college and they had three options. They could be a teacher, a nurse, or a secretary. Then all of a sudden, the doors have opened and it's been fantastic. There are all these choices out there. We can do anything. We can do everything. But because it's so new, we really haven't had a chance to deal with the decision-making process or to learn that the message about having it all really isn't quite true. And we just don't have the generational role models that, say, men have had, you know, for centuries. And so it's a bit of trial and error, and I think we're feeling our way and just starting to understand the compromises that have to be made.
Yeah.
And I think that's difficult.
Yeah, it is difficult. In fact, a number of years ago, I interviewed Chris Gregoire, who was then our Attorney General. She's now our governor.
Oh, right.
And it was for a print article. And she said that she told me then, you look, Vicky, when I came out of school, you were a nurse, you were a teacher, or you were a secretary.
Exactly.
Until you got married. That was it. And I decided none of those fit me. And now she's the governor of our state. Despite what people think of her, she's
yeah.
done well, you know.
Exactly.
So you do say if people believe they're going to have it all, if young women believe they're going to have it all, they will be disappointed to some extent. Talk to us a little bit about that.
Yeah, I think it's true. I think the whole message about having it all kind of makes it feel like, oh, sure, I can be the attorney general, or I can be a doctor, or I could be a politician, and I can have a fabulous family life to boot. And the reality is you can't have it all at the same time. You can't be at your job, you know, for 52 hours a week, which I think is what most full-time jobs break down to
Wow. Now,
and be outside taking your kids to the park or organizing play dates. It's not possible. You can do both of those things, but not exactly at the same time, or you can do both of those things, but you'll have to compromise somewhat in your standards and your expectations. And I think that's kind of a hard message.
Yeah, and you mentioned earlier that men have the same choices. They might have the same choices, but they've had generations of role models going before to tell how to get through this. So how do women support each other and become role models for each other and for the next generation?
I think the first step is recognizing it and talking about it, you know, and realizing we're all on the same boat in kind of a state of transition, or we call it growing pains.
Mm-hmm.
And we're feeling our way. Also, we have to be honest about the demands that are made in the workplace. I think, you know, we talk a lot about work-life balance, but if you're working 52 hours a week and if we're connected at all possible times with, you know, Twitter and texts and mm-hmm. emails, you don't really get away from that. And I think a conversation has to begin. And then there's also more sharing at home. I think men today are doing a much better job than their fathers or grandfathers ever did. But I think research has shown that women still have the bulk of the second shift.
Yeah, yeah. I hear that all the time from women, regardless of how good somebody, you know, their husband may be in the home. I hear it all the time.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's kind of the culture, you know, this is the way the culture has been for years and years and years and years. And it's kind of hard to break away from that paradigm, I think. Mm-hmm. I think. And interestingly, one of the people we did, you know, a massive amount of interviewing for the book. And one of our interviews was with Ellen Galinsky, who's the head of the Work and Family Institute. And they've been working on work and family issues for decades. And they recently did a study that showed that the stress level for women was about the same as it had been for the past several years. But for men, it was rising. And she kind of saw that as an indication that men absolutely are doing more at home and taking more responsibility for their kids, but are kind of experiencing the stress that women have felt for years, which is kind of interesting. I mean, the good news is it looks like things are starting to shift, but the bad news is men are getting as stressed out as their wives are.
Yeah, that's not going to be good.
No, you know, it's not so good.
So you talk about the science of decision making in your book, because part of what you talk about is, you know, we have so many options that it can lead to more pressure, more overwhelm. Talk a little bit about the science of decision making, if you would.
Great. It's really fascinating, but the easiest way to describe it is what's called opportunity cost. And what it means is if you're doing A, you can't be doing B. But if the options are close together or there are multiple options, there's an assumption that one of those must be perfect. Barry Schwartz is kind of the guru of the science of choice. He's a psychologist at Swarthmore, and he always uses the analogy of shopping for jeans, which, you know, as we all know, is always a nightmare. But he said in the old days when you had, you know, Lee's or Levi's to choose from, you just picked a pair and you were happy with it. He said now you go into a store, and there's just hundreds of different kinds of jeans, you know, different kinds of washes, different kinds of fits, so on and so forth. So you're assuming, okay, I'm going to go try these on, and one of them is going to fit perfectly. And so you make your choice, agonize over which pair you're going to buy. You make your choice, and of course it isn't perfect. And so you have a sense of regret. It's not that there's no perfect pair of jeans, but it's that you chose wrong. And that plays into it, too, this whole idea of second-guessing yourself or looking over your shoulder, wondering what you've missed out on. It's a sense of regret.
Mm. So how do we, the message that you can do anything you want, we're often raised with that. How do you turn that around to leave you feeling as though anything less than perfect is good enough? And is good enough good enough?
Going back to Barry Schwartz, when we were interviewing him, he referenced a study last year, not quite last year, it was maybe 6 or 9 months ago, that found that people were a lot happier and more satisfied with their life as they got older. I think it was a survey of people over 50. And he interpreted that as a realization based on life experience that good enough really is good enough. And so it's kind of looking backwards and saying, yeah, you know what? That was okay. The other thing is, of course, realizing that perfect doesn't exist, you know, and not beating yourself over the head trying to chase that fantasy all the time.
Right.
And another issue is knowing yourself. We talk in the book about dispensing with the shoulds. You know, what do your parents think you should do? What does society think you should do? What do your professors think you should do? And I think for women especially who are somewhat hardwired to please, it's really hard to get away from that and tune in to what you really want.
Yeah, and I think sometimes even if you figure that out, you can backslide with pressure or just with time. You have to constantly focus on that.
Sure. Sure, and then there are the compromises you have to make along the way.
Mm-hmm.
One of the women in our book, we called her Lori. She's very accomplished. She has an MFA in poetry. She has taught English at kind of an outdoor school. She's been an accidental reporter. Now she's a member of her local school board, and she works for a nonprofit, and she was talking about a reunion she had with a lot of her college mates who had gone to Notre Dame. And she said, you know, we're sitting around, and we're doctors, we're lawyers, we're PhD candidates, so on and so forth, and we're all mothers, too. And she said, all of us are career-oriented. You know, we're on career paths with climbable ladders, and we don't want to give that up. And yet we're conflicted about leaving our kids in daycare.
Yeah.
And you know, we never learned how to navigate that kind of tricky, sticky terrain.
Yeah. You interviewed a lot of women for the book. Was there a common thread with most of the women that you talked about?
That's a good question. I think the common thread was kind of wondering if they had made the right choice, should they make another one? Why is it that the promises of, quote, having it all haven't played out? And I think that's what we heard a lot. That was the refrain. Mm. You know, a lot of students saying, or excuse me, a lot of women saying, you know, this is what I was promised when I was in undergraduate or in grad school, but somehow it just isn't working.
Yeah. What did you learn about yourself, Barbara? Because I don't think you can undertake a challenge like this and do the investigation that you did without coming away changed yourself a little.
Yeah, I think one of the things was reducing my expectations for myself. You know, I'm an inveterate list maker, and every morning I make a to-do list, and there are always, you know, so many more things on the list that I can possibly undertake or get done. And I've learned to tell myself, you know what, it's okay. Mm-hmm. Cross out two or three and do a good job, that's fine. And I also try to keep with the mantra of good enough really is good enough.
Yeah, I think that is something I need to adopt too.
Yeah, I know. I know, it's really hard.
I was just going to ask you a question, just flew right out of my head then. But you don't have a website, do you? I didn't see a website, but I did see a really good blog that listeners can go to and find out more about you and the work that you're doing with Shannon.
Yes, it is www.undecidedthebook.wordpress.com.
And I love the quote on there at the top. It says, analysis paralysis, grass is greener syndrome, longing for the road not traveled, how the success of the women's movement has left us stumped in the face of limitless options and how to get over it. And that's what it's all about, isn't it? It's about, getting over it.
It really is. And, you know, we're not saying there was anything wrong with the women's movement. In fact, what we're saying is, we haven't gone far enough. It's kind of, our book is kind of the unfinished business of the women's movement. Let's take it forward and keep moving.
Yeah. Well, we're almost at the end of our segment. What would you like to listeners to take away with them today? If they just take away one thing, what do you hope that would be?
To realize that there's no such thing as having it all for men or women. And also, another message of our book is that we're experiencing growing pains, and a lot of this is trial and error. You know, be willing to take a risk. Be willing to fail.
Mm. Well, give us a quick example of how you've taken a risk, how you failed maybe.
Ooh, how have I failed? Probably too many to count.
Well, I just read the 4-Hour Work Week, and there's a lot of people in there who failed and come through.
Yeah, I think one area I failed, before I went to graduate school in journalism, I thought I wanted to go into advertising because I thought, oh, it's really fun and sexy and glamorous and creative. And I found out it really was none of the above, and also that I wasn't very good at it. But you know what? It was great because that kind of prompted me to think, well, what do I really want to do? And what I always wanted to do was be a reporter. So I went to journalism school and...
There you go. Taking that risk. Well, I thank you for being with us today. Sorry Shannon couldn't join us, but I enjoyed talking with you, Barbara.
Oh, I love talking to you, Vicki.
And give us your website, your blog one more time, please.
Okay, it is www.undecidedthebook.wordpress.com.
Super. Thank you.
Thank you.
My guest, Barbara Kelly, she wrote this book with her daughter, Shannon Kelly. It's called Undecided, How to Ditch the Endless Quest for Perfect and Find the Career and Life That's Right for You. So hopefully with the three guests today, we've come away a little bit wiser on how we can make some decisions and choices in life. And we'll be back, or we won't be back next week live because it's Memorial Day, but I do wish you a great weekend next weekend. I hope you are taking some time off and getting some recreation in there and turning off your pages and your texts and your phones and just getting out there and having some fun. Thanks for being with us today. You can find out more about us at conversationslive.net. You can follow me on Twitter at Vicki St. Clair. And you can reach me by phone at 800-495-7617, 495-7617, or info@conversationslive.net. Live well, live strong.